Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife as we talk with our two guests today about wildlife as winter kind of turns into spring here in Wisconsin. Jamie Knack and David Drake, our guests today. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Larry.
And David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. David, nice to see you as well.
Nice to see you, and spring cannot come soon enough.
Yeah, exactly right. They are both with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Of course, we want to hear from you. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. David, spring migration should be starting soon. I always loved it when the ice went out or goes out on Lake Monona and all the ducks and, the loons come in. But there are a lot of birds that come before that.
Yeah, there sure are. And as a matter of fact, I was just looking out my plate glass window, the front of my house yesterday, and saw a robin. It was one of the first ones I've seen, although I know they've been around for a bit of time. I have heard sandhill cranes coming in, which is nice. I have not seen cedar waxwings or heard cedar waxwings, but I'm sure they're around. And again, obviously, we're talking about the southern part of the state. Up in the northern part of the state, things are going to be a little bit delayed relative to what we're seeing down here. But cedar waxwings are relatively early migratory birds. Bluebirds also, I haven't seen them, but they should be coming in pretty soon. And we should be about a month and a half or so away from really the start of true spring migration. That's the bird world. Obviously, there's a number of waterfowl, again, down here in the southern part of the state. You see the Ohio River and some of the open water. You're starting to see some nice waterfowl there. In terms of bats, we've got 8 different species of bats in the state. 4 of them leave our area for the winter and migrate south, and 4 of them hibernate for the winter and stay here. So probably another, 2 to 4 weeks or so, we should start seeing bats. And on some of those nicer, warmer evenings, we might start seeing a few bats here and there sooner rather than later. But it's a nice harbinger that spring's coming. On my bike ride in to work this morning, I heard cardinals singing and chickadees singing, and started to see male cardinals up near the top of trees, which is an indication that they're ready to breed. And so, as I mentioned, spring can't get here soon enough, but there are signs that it is coming, and that's good to see.
Well, we have we've got some good news. That's good news always to see that spring is on the way, but there's a new study that shows that nearly half of all bald eagles are suffering from lead poisoning, which is not so nice. Jamie, what's being done to stop this?
Yeah, well, let me talk a little bit about the research that just came out. So this research was published in the Journal of Science, and it is essentially based on, I'm trying to get the number here, the researchers examined the blood, bones, and feathers, as well as liver tissue of 1,210 eagles sampled between 2010 and 2018. And just thinking about where those samples came from, the blood samples came from live eagles as an opportunistic, an opportunity when the birds were trapped and studied for other reasons. So that blood was then also able to be incorporated into this study. And then the bone, feather, and liver samples came from eagles that were collected that had been killed by collisions with vehicles or power lines or other misfortunes. And the results of the study, so of those 1,210 eagles, harmful levels of toxic lead were found of 46% of the 30 of the eagles sampled. And just to talk about the breadth or the geographic area, this covers samples from 38 states, from California to Florida.
Wow. So it's kind of everywhere.
Yeah. And, again, this is still a sample size, right? It can vary geographically, the rates that they saw. But from the samples they collected, there was 46% that had harmful levels of lead toxicity. Mm. And so they also had looked at golden eagles and found similar rates. But then the study went further and examined and projected what the population decline might be as a result of the lead in the system. Yeah. And this would be the first time where for any wildlife species that we've been able to evaluate lead exposure in terms of a population level consequence. So we know individually lead is toxic to animals, but what's the population consequence? And the study's estimating that lead exposure reduced the annual growth of bald eagles by 4% and golden eagles by 1%. And so that's not to say, and then the potential cause here then is lead in hunting ammunition. So deer hunting, especially, the researchers found elevated levels of lead exposure in the fall and the winter, which does coincide with many hunting seasons in the states where they were sampled. And also it can be in fishing equipment, sinkers, as well. And so these eagles are scavenging on carcasses or gut piles or catching fish that have fishing equipment in that lead tackle in them. And so not to say, you know, the upshot of the research isn't to disparage hunters. That's not the point here. I think we can all agree that hunters provide the lion's share of funding in terms of license revenue and excise taxes and do a lot for conservation. But to continue to have the discussion looking at the results of this research and encouraging hunters to voluntarily switch to non-lead ammunition, such as copper bullets, and also the same for fishing tackle, switching to a non-toxic alternative.
And there are good ones out there.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just say, you know, I'm a deer hunter myself. And about 14 years ago, when I was pregnant with our first child, I made that switch from a human health standpoint and went from lead to copper bullets. And thankfully, I have a father who's a very avid reloader. And that was accessible to me and fairly easy to do, and have found very good performance with the copper bullets. And with two young daughters that, you know, continue to hunt, and We eat a lot of wild game. We've primarily switched to all non-toxic from a human health standpoint, and feel good about, you know, what we're doing in terms of a wildlife conservation standpoint as well. So I think this research will really continue the discussion.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Jim and Stevens Point, we'll go to you. Jim, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. For about the last month or so, I have had flocks of common red poles. And when I looked in my field guide for birds, I noticed that it was 7 years ago that I had a common red pole and haven't had any since. And I'm looking at them now, and they're all over the place. I was kind of wondering why that would happen.
You know, and I'll just add here, we had an email from Paul in De Pere that he had the pleasure of hosting 80 to 100 common red poles for the last month or so at their Niger thistle feeders, and the last 2 days, none have shown up. And he was wondering if they'd started to, you know, migrating back north again. He's in De Pere. So a couple of things there relating to red poles. David, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that. So red poles, we hear this a lot of times, but red poles are kind of this eruptive species where you'll see them in some years, and others years you don't. The pine siskins are another species like that, where you might see them at the feeder in good, you know, decent numbers. Other years you don't, and it could be a variety of reasons, but probably it's mostly driven by habitat and probably most likely food availability. So, in some years, if they find a good, convenient source of food, be it a human provided source of food like the thistle or the Niger seed that was discussed. Or it could be an available natural food source. You know, they'll get on that and they'll stay on that. And so some years they may not come to the feeders either because they don't migrate or move into that particular local area. Or they're in that local area and they found a food source and that kind of holds them where they are. So that's generally the most common reason why you see these species that are kind of eruptive and And some years they show up, some years they don't. Weather can be a bit of a factor as well. You know, we haven't had it, especially in the southern part of the state, we have not had a lot of snow cover, and especially not consistent snow cover. And so there's a good amount of available natural food source available for these animals too. And they're not necessarily driven to the feeders because they're finding what they need out in the natural areas.
And into Paul and DePere, it's likely that the birds have just moved on then.
They'll flock up again. You know, they'll flock up in the wintertime and then start moving through areas as well. And that might be what Paul has seen up in DePere. But, the red poles and, you know, pine siskins, all that, they're such a delight to have at feeders. But, you don't always see them consistently year after year, unfortunately.
And, Jim, thank you for calling. Vivian in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Vivian.
Hi. One observation, anecdotal, and then a question. I've been privileged to watch the eagles return to Marinette County on the Menominee River over the last 50-plus years. So they were really rare back then, as were the otters, but they both increased a lot. But at one point, my dog and I were walking the trail along the river, and it's not developed, and I heard a sneeze, which just kind of stopped me in my tracks because there aren't any people. And I looked around and thought we were alone. I looked up, and there was an eagle in a tree about 30 feet, and it continued to sneeze. And believe me, it sounded like a human sneeze. I followed up with a couple of questions to the DNR, and the thought was this eagle was in poor health, quite likely, with West Nile virus. There was no way I could assist it because it was up in the tree. It did look bedraggled. But my question is, if the eagles that are fishing, of course, are lead contaminated, what about the osprey?
Yeah, Jamie?
Yeah, so I think ospreys certainly fall within that group as well. The Raptor Education Group, which is out of Anago, if we spoke with Marge Gibson and looked at their intakes of animals, I think we'd see a number of raptors, including osprey, and then also not a raptor, but loons that are diving and consuming fish as well. So, yes, osprey would be included.
Yeah, there you go. Interesting observation, though, on the eagle kind of sneezing.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with eagles being susceptible to West Nile virus. I mean, typically it's the corvids, you know, crows and, you know, blue jays, things like that. But I'm not familiar with eagles being susceptible to West Nile virus, but perhaps that is what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the state does track, you know, the bald eagle nests. In fact, the last survey, I believe it was all but one or two of our 72 counties had an active bald eagle nest. Just again, you know, describing the conservation success there. And those local biologists, you might be able to reach back out to them and see if they know the status of that nest and if there is a pair using it. And You know, sometimes people are pretty tuned into the history.
Yeah,
that's a good point. That, you know, the caller was obviously concerned about the welfare of that individual eagle, and obviously you'd like it not to suffer. But the eagle population is very healthy in Wisconsin and many parts of the United States. So even though that eagle may not fare well, it's not gonna hamper or hinder the sustainability of the eagle population in Wisconsin for sure.
Vivian, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guest today, as we take a look at the world of wildlife. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at wildlife today on the show with David Drake and Jamie Nack. Extension. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. David, a professor, both are in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them with us. You can join with calls at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, even a photo, to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of photos, a listener emailed a photo hoping for an ID on some tracks that he or she had seen in eastern Marinette County, about 1.5 to 2 inches in diameter. And I'm not sure. Any ideas there, Jamie?
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. There are, just for the listeners, there are just two imprints, so that makes it a little harder.
Yes.
Because you don't see the full gate. So if you ever do take pictures, it's always great to put some sort of frame of reference next to the track. You could use a dollar bill. You could use a quarter, a Swiss Army knife, anything like that. That just gives us a frame of reference, although the caller did give us the dimensions. And then another photo that would be of the gates, or a series of tracks. So you can see how the front and hind legs register in this case on the snow. So, but looking at it, you can see that there's four toe prints. And so my best guess with the size and what I'm seeing is either a red fox or a domestic cat.
It does, now that I look at it, it does look like a cat print too. It could be.
Yep.
Alan in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Larry and guests. I was driving on I-94 just west of Delafield, and on the right-hand emergency lane, I saw, unfortunately, what looked like a dead coyote, but as I got closer, it became clear that it was some kind of cat, be it a bobcat or a cougar. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that population here in southeastern Wisconsin.
Bobcats.
Yes, I'll start, and Jamie, please add in as you want. So, so bobcats are a increase in numbers, and they are in the southern part of the state in pretty healthy numbers, as a matter of fact. And for some reason, bobcats are not as much of an urban adapted or an animal in urban areas in the Midwestern cities as they are, for example, in the Western cities. So in Los Angeles, Phoenix, down in the south part of the state, or south part of the country, Houston, Atlanta, they have bobcats in the city limits that live there permanently. We don't seem to have that. We have bobcats that move through Madison, Milwaukee, you know, some other cities in Wisconsin, but they don't, for some reason, they tend not to stay in those cities. So, but bobcats are very, very abundant in the southern part of the state. A lot of good habitat down here for them. And it's likely that that's probably what you saw. Obviously, what you'd look for is that bobbed tail, or that very short tail in the animal. If you see the belly, they have spots, black spots and white fur on the belly, and kind of a tall-legged animal. So a really beautiful. When you see a bobcat, you don't confuse it with much else. It's highly unlikely it's a cougar or what we would refer to as a mountain lion in this area. There have been mountain lions obviously moving through Wisconsin in the last decade or so, even down in the southern part of the state. But you would not confuse a mountain lion with anything else, simply because it's such a large animal, big head, but it also has that long rope-like tail that is very, very distinct. And you would not make a misidentification if you saw that. So it's likely it was a bobcat. But again, you know, coyotes are very common down this area. And depending on how badly the animal got hit, it could be a coyote as well.
Alan, thank you for calling. Ross in Middleton, it's your turn. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry and guests. So I have some property over in Crawford County. And, you know, it's hilly and wooded. It was mostly, in the older days, it was oak, and it's getting taken over by maple. And so I spent a lot of time clearing the maples out, mostly the shorter ones. They're like 10 foot tall and stuff like that. And some of the bigger ones, so it's more open. And then a redheaded woodpecker moved into the area. I sort of know that redheaded woodpeckers like these open woodlands, but I was just wondering if the guests could just shed a little bit more light. What was it? What is it about a redheaded woodpecker that he doesn't like these sort of maples, and sort of once it opened up, he moved in, he or she moved in.
Mm-hmm. I'll jump on this one as well. Yeah. So redheaded woodpeckers have, as a population, have been declining, or I should say have declined, maybe over the last couple of decades. As you mentioned, they do like these open habitats. So more of a savanna, oak savanna type habitat, where you've got some grasslands, but then you have dotted trees here and there. And that tends to be what they like. They seem to be coming back in numbers in the last recent years. And they were first sighted on golf courses. And golf courses are a nice kind of a substitute oak savanna, because you have that open area with you know, dots of trees. You don't have as tall and as an extensive amount of grassland on a golf course as you would in an oak savanna, for example. But golf courses are a nice substitute for oak savanna, and people started seeing redhead woodpeckers there, and they do seem to be coming back. And my mom has got about 70 acres of forested property up in the central part of Minnesota. They get redhead woodpeckers up there. When she first said that to me, I said, "Are you sure it's a redhead woodpecker and not, a red-bellied or something else?" And she's like, "No, and my mom's a good birder. I mean, she knows her birds." And I'm like, "Well, it just seems strange that they would be in such, you know, dense forest land." But they're up there. And so I don't know exactly what is going on, if they're starting to adapt to a bit of a more forested landscape, or perhaps we as ecologists have misidentified exactly what they need. But they do tend to be in more of a forested landscape as well as these open oak savannas. And why they do or don't like the maples, I'm not exactly sure about that, because typically, you know, if they can find trees that have some dead wood to them so they can excavate a cavity and they can find food sources and things like that, that should suffice regardless of what type of a tree it typically is. Although they do tend to like those, tend to kind of favor more of a hardwood forest composition. But it's interesting that you're seeing them in more of a contiguous woodland like you described.
Yeah. Thanks, Ross. Appreciate it. Susan in Appleton, we'll turn to you.
Good afternoon. I have a question about providing nesting materials for birds that are returning this spring. What is the right time to start putting out nesting materials, and what do you recommend as nesting materials?
Susan, before, just wanted to catch you before you hang up. What type of bird nest boxes or species are you trying to attract?
Well, really any kind of bird, and I'm not talking about a nest box. I'm talking about like putting out for hummingbirds or songbirds, putting out nesting materials, nuthatches, whatever.
Sure.
Sure. So, you know, certainly, I know of people that will get horsehair, long hair, feathers, different things like that, and leave them kind of scattered around the yard. It's always interesting to me checking nest boxes, and I guess now's a good time to put that plug in. But now is the time to open up those bluebird houses and clean them out. And same for the wood duck boxes. Wood duck boxes you want to replenish with shavings again, wood shavings. But anyway, you can kind of take apart the nest and see what they've been gathering, and you'll find hair and things like that. And in our case, we find dog hair in the nest, and again, you know, feathers from around the yard. We have chickens, and I think we're finding some of that chicken feathers within the house run nest. So one website I really wanted to direct folks to that is just absolutely fascinating, has a lot of really great information, is Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Nest Watch. And they have sections there all about birdhouses, nest identification and egg identification. And I believe you'd find even better information there in terms of what materials you could place around the yard or how to place them around the yard, to be there for the birds as they start to build those nests. So I'd really point you in the direction there. They have some excellent information and resources available.
Susan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. You mentioned nests, and that reminded me of the Decora Eagle cam and nest. And maybe a comment on that, Jamie. That's
sure,
fun.
I was talking to Jill before the show, and it's kind of addicting, so be careful. But because you do want to get outside now, but next winter maybe too, go back, because a lot of these are recorded. But there are a number of cameras on nests of birds throughout the country. The Decora Eagle nests have been recorded for a number of years, and if you go to raptorresource.org, that website has information on the Decora Eagle nests, and you can watch them live. And in some cases, these cameras are, there's multiple cameras on the nest. The Decora Eagle has a chat function with it. And from 8:30 to 10:30 in the morning, and again for a couple hours in the afternoon, there are staff monitoring those chats and answering questions. The first egg in that nest was laid on February 16th in terms of talking about eagle phenology here. The second egg was laid on February 19th, and they have a countdown to the projected hatch, which right now would be in about 23 days. So tune in, you know, you might be able to watch the hatching. And then what they also do then is they'll record interesting segments and kind of have them pulled out. So the other day I was looking, and a coyote was caught on camera below the nest. You know, the eagles were very safe, but the coyote was foraging underneath in the snow, and they captured that on the camera. And they capture, you know, the fish and different prey items that the eagles are bringing back for each other, and then the eaglets down the road. And then another place to go to see some bird cameras kind of in one location is to go to Cornell again and type in bird cams. And they have a camera on a great horned owl in Savannah, Georgia right now. And another favorite one is, so Cornell is in Ithaca, New York, and they have a camera on their feeders. And so they're monitoring kind of what's coming in. And just recently there was pine grosbeaks. They had a rough grouse coming into the feeder, so you can go back and see that. And then we talk about this on the show a fair amount with flying squirrels coming into feeders at night. And they've had some videos of flying squirrels in the evenings coming into their feeders. And I think you'd really enjoy looking at that. But again, it's addicting. what these birds are up to. But boy, when you look at those Decora eagles on the nest, and just beautiful, beautiful animals. So,
well, speaking of,
check it out.
Yeah. Speaking of nests and nesting, I think Tim in Madison has a related question. So let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yeah, I've got a question. I've got a nesting family of falcons, or at least I have for the last few years. I bought a house out down in Hollandale, and they had a box stacked on the side of a tree, and they were there up until last year. Now, I don't know if I'm supposed to clean that box out, and also there's looks like there's a piece of grass or straw that is sitting kind of in front of the entryway to the nest. So I didn't see them last year, so I'm wondering if that's causing a problem.
Are you talking about a kestrel box?
They're small. They're some kind of small falcon. They look like
a
falcon.
I think you must be. I'm assuming you're referring to an American kestrel versus a peregrine falcon, and kestrel boxes are very common. A lot of times you'll see them put up along roadways on telephone poles, and if you do that, make sure you get the utility company's permission before you do that yourself. Even if the telephone pole is on your property or near your property. But, so I'm assuming you're talking about kestrel boxes, which are very common. I'm not aware of kestrels being in boxes yet, although they should be here pretty soon. So if you want to clean that box out, now's the time to go ahead and do that quickly. As to whether or not that grass, blade of grass sticking out was what stopped the kestrel from using that box, I would doubt that. Either the kestrel found other natural nesting area, or there was something else going on, but I doubt that was it. But if you're interested in cleaning out the box, go ahead and do that now, and then the kestrels should be probably in the next week or two start looking for nesting sites.
There you go, Tim. Thank you. Jerry in Pittsville, let's go to you. Hi, Jerry.
Hi there. I was calling to talk about, I live in Pittsville, and I'm not in the city, but out, kind of out in the county. I'm surrounded by farmers, and I don't know, about a month ago, a group of neighbors came over by my house in the evening, and they said, hey, just to let you know, they were getting up early to go milk, and they said they saw four or five wolves run out of my driveway onto the road while they were driving into their farm, and they wanted me to know that those wolves were around, and heck, I didn't even know there was wolves in central Wisconsin, and I don't know if there's any precautions I need to take. I mean, I've got a dog and, you know, all that kind of stuff, chickens and,
sure.
And, then within about a day, I saw groups of guys in trucks with dogs and collars, and I wasn't sure what was allowed or not allowed or what's going on there.
Here we go.
Thanks. Thanks, Jerry. So certainly our wolf population is in northern and central Wisconsin. So I have no reason to believe that wouldn't have been true, that was a wolf pack. In terms of what you should do, I mean, certainly be aware that, you know, that is possible to be coming across them. As far as your dog, you know, keeping the dog close if you're going for a walk, and even around the yard, you know, make sure that's a dog that kind of stays near the yard. In terms of the hunters that you saw, my guess is that you probably saw coyote hunters, and coyote hunting is an activity that can be done year round, but snow is really advantageous. And so that's what you were seeing there, radio callers on dogs, and they'd set down on a coyote track and hope to pursue that coyote in front of a hunter. So, yeah pretty common in rural Wisconsin.
And we should mention, though, that the wolves have just been listed again as an endangered species. So right now, there is no lethal management of wolves at all, with the exception of if you need to protect yourself or somebody else as a human. You can lethally control wolves in that instant, but only in that instant. But other than that, because they are protected according to the Endangered Species Act right now, which is a recent ruling, but there's no lethal management of wolves right now anywhere in the state.
Thank you, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. Gene in Ashland, we'll go to you now. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that ladies or anybody who knits or crochets, if you put colorful scraps of yarn, I used to have a crew that I would just stuff it into a cavity, and they would, the birds would pull it out. We have the most colorful nests. They also would take scraps from the tarp that was on the wood pile and pull until they got a shiny piece of thread from that and put it, and we had really pretty nests. That's all.
Oh, thanks, Jean.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for sharing that. We've actually, now that you mention it, we've had the same situation with old tarps covering our woodpile and finding some of that material within nests as well. So thank you.
You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Rolf in Hayward emailed to ask, what can possibly be the reason for using lead if data clearly indicates it's such a problem? Why not ban it rather than get voluntary to use non-lead options? Seems dishonest at best to put a positive spin on the use of it.
Yeah, so really, really good question, and I'm glad you brought it up. But, you know, some of this comes down to, you know, if you're using ammunition for shooting sports, so trap shooting, sighting in firearms at a range, you wouldn't necessarily be using non-toxic there. So there is a cost difference, and you can make the argument that, okay, for a box of shells to go deer hunting, that cost difference is really not that big of a deal. But from a shooting range or a shooting sports standpoint, that adds up when you're talking about boxes of shells, and that lead is deposited in usually a more confined space. But in addition, there's pushback in terms of just, you know, people having inventory of lead ammunition and have maybe even stocked up in recent years with that ammunition and want to be able to use it. And in some cases, some of the more unusual calibers of rifles, that technology maybe isn't as readily available, or those bullets aren't as readily available for some. So, again, you know, you can certainly look on it, do some Googling in terms of that lead and non-toxic, you know, debate, but those are some of the concerns from the other side. And just, you know, we need time to catch up from a manufacturing standpoint, as well. So, but I appreciate the question.
Mike in Lake Mills, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I just had a point, a question for the expert. I, too, would put out yarn and things for the birds, but then I'd read that sometimes they can be a problem because they don't break apart like natural materials, even if you use, you know, especially if you use nylon. And I, I had the unfortunate experience of having a baby in a wren nest that I found after they left that had been strangled by it. So I wonder if, and I don't know that Audubon has a policy on that. I'm wondering what your expert has to say. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
I can chime in, and that's kind of why I was hesitant to say any more about the yarn, and kind of pointed folks to that NestWatch website as a really good source of information in terms of best practices for that. But that was why I was hesitant to mention some of those other more non-natural objects, or you know, yarn and the tarp material and things like that. So sticking to hair and feathers, things like that. So
thanks.
I point you to the Cornell site again to do some more research.
Dawn in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, my name is Dawn, and I'm retired from the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. And it just caught my ear when you were talking about nest cams, because several years ago when I was working there, I worked with some people from our local Audubon Society. And since I was on buildings and grounds crew, we worked with Greg Septon to put up a falcon box on one of our buildings, and because we have a nesting pair up there, and they've changed throughout the years. Our original female is now an educational bird because she had an accident and was not able to be re-released, but it's fun watching our falcon cam, and I think the website is falconcam.edu.
All right.
So it's just really interesting watching, and a lot of people will, because they know that when I was working with the falcon box and cleaning it out on a regular basis. But people will say, "Oh, our falcons are back," but actually, our falcons here never leave.
Dawn, thanks a lot. Have you guys either of you seen that cam at falconcam.edu? I've got to have looked that up.
Yeah, that sounds pretty neat. Peregrine falcons in cities are very common. As a matter of fact, a lot of cities have what we used to call hack boxes, or now nesting boxes, on the tops of buildings and are occupied by falcons. And yes, it's neat to see peregrine falcons that are actually doing well as a population. It's really neat to see them in cities.
Yeah, actually, I have one in, I've had a pair in Madison around the Capitol for quite a while.
Yep.
Dawn, thank you. Shelley in Lake Mills, it's your turn. Hi, Shelley. Oh, we lost Shelley. I'll tell you what, this gives me a good opportunity to remind you that our two guests today are David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack, an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. And an email from Jim. Jim says that house cats roam his neighborhood, and some, if not all, frequent his bird feeders, and wonders if there are laws or methods for discouraging these cats, or laws for eliminating controlling feral cats and house cats, in parentheses, that prey on birds and other wildlife.
David? I guess I'll take this one. So, I've been here since 2005, and I remember prior to me moving to the state and taking this job at UW, that there was a kind of a resolution, I think, going through Conservation Congress to enact a law that you could legally shoot feral cats. And essentially, feral cats are considered under Wisconsin statute an unprotected species. So if it is a feral cat, you can legally and lethally kill that animal. The problem is this, that a lot of pet owners do let their cats outside, unfortunately, and there's good documentation in the scientific literature about the amount of negative impact these cats have on a whole wide variety of wildlife species, not only free-ranging birds, but small mammals, reptiles, amphibians, things like that. So please do not let your cat outside. It is not good for the wildlife. It is not good for your cat. And if you talk to your veterinarian, they should encourage you to keep your cat inside for the cat's health alone. So do not let your cat outside, please. If you let your cat outside, either keep her on a leash. They now are promoting what's called catios, which is essentially as a patio for your cat. Things like that. You know, people do say suggest sometimes that putting bells on the cat's collar if it's a free ranging cat. But cats have been able to figure out how to move and stalk without those bells ringing. So bells are not necessarily effective. And again, you still have a free-ranging cat out there. So if you must let your cat outside, please keep it on a leash or keep it enclosed in a catio or something like that. The problem with having a law about shooting feral cats or the fact that it's an unprotected species right now, but you don't know if that's a feral cat or if that's somebody's house cat, a pet cat. And that's what the real problem is. Now, if you're out in the country and there aren't houses around you for, you know, half a mile or something like that, it's likely it's a feral cat. But if you're in the city, it's just as good a chance that somebody's domestic house cat. And as much as you may not like cats and the destruction they do when they're outside, do have some empathy that this is somebody's pet. And you probably want to avoid, you know, permanently harming this animal. The better thing to do is if you can track down who that cat belongs to, go and knock on their door. Be very, very polite about it. Don't be threatening. Don't judge them, but just be very polite and maybe arm yourself with some facts and try to, in the most diplomatic way you can, really suggest that they keep their cat indoors for, again, the health of the cat and the health of the wildlife community.
And Larry, if I can just chime in too, I wanted to just offer the caller a couple of resources too, but a really good place to look for additional information on the impacts on wildlife is American Bird Conservancy's Cats Indoor campaign. And through the work that they've done too, you know, they really are sensitive to the fact that cat owners, you know, believe their cats have a right to be outside and, you know, feel strongly about cats being able to, you know, exercise their natural instincts and so on. That the messaging seems to be more effective when you talk about the fact that indoor cats live twice as long or outdoor cats live half as long as a well taken care of indoor cat. So maybe switching the messaging. And then another thing, if you're finding that cat is stalking your bird feeders, is again, when you're feeding birds, make sure that you have cover nearby, but not right at the feeder. You want to make sure that cover is 10 feet or more away so that cover is not serving as an ambush location for those cats. And I agree completely with David. The best way I think to handle this is to have a conversation with the neighbors or the neighborhood and see if you can come to similar minds.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you for that question. Willie in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Willie.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to ask your experts about avian influenza. I heard that it's kind of making its way across the country and that it might cause problems for wildlife rescues, especially that take in birds. And if the experts could provide any insight into that and what the public might do if they find any dead birds. Thank you.
Yeah, so unfortunately, avian influenza seems to be popping back up, and they are starting to track that again. So, you know, again, the best thing to do is try to limit interaction between wild birds and domestic fowl is very important. Good sanitary practices, if you have domestic birds around, is very important. And if you see dead birds, especially, you know, waterfowl, chickens, things like that, if you have one or two spaced over, you know, a week or two, it's probably not as concerning. But if you see multiples of birds in relatively short periods of time, so if you see two or three or four or five one day and then another multiple birds, you know, a couple of days later, the best thing to do is to call your county wildlife biologist and notify them, and then they will get in touch with the proper wildlife health experts, either within the state Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or the U.S. Geological Survey National Wildlife Health Lab, and they will track that. They'll also get in touch with DADCAP, which is the state agriculture agency here, to make sure that they are watching that and protecting domestic flocks such as chickens, turkeys, things like that. But yeah, it is starting to pop back up. So good sanitary practices and as much as you can, barriers between domestic birds and wild birds is good practice.
And thanks again, Willie, for calling. Brianne in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Brianne.
Hi. I had a question for your guest today about bat houses. I live in the country just outside Green Bay, and we have some bats who like to live under the eaves of our roof and then as well in our garage next to the chimney for the wood burner. And my husband and I bought some bat boxes last year, but we're not really sure where to put them, when to put them up. I know that I'm not supposed to put them in a tree so a raccoon doesn't climb up in them. But do you have any additional resources?
Absolutely, and very timely phone call, because now now is the time to go ahead and erect those bat houses for summer roosting locations. If you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and in their search box type in bat houses, you will find information on how to build them yourself if you'd like to, and then information on placement. And then another really good source is Bat Conservation International. They will have some of the same information there. So those are, to me, by far and away the best sources of information. In Wisconsin, we need to have bat houses that are painted black or brown to absorb more of the sun's heat, and need to be placed in a location where they're going to get sun at least 6 hours or more out of the day. So on a pole, as high up as possible, is a really good location in an open area as they're feeding on flying insects, or on the south or east facing side of a building. The ones on a pole, if you're going to mount it on a pole, it's best to have a multiple chamber bat house so that the bats have options in terms of where they locate themselves, whether it's in the very interior of the bat house or on, so they can regulate their heat basically throughout the day. On a building, you can probably get away with a single or a double chamber bat house. So I think you'll find more than enough information on either of those websites and tips on attracting, and then also tips on maybe getting them, excluding them from the areas where you don't want to have them. And just as a reminder to all listeners, there's a period of time where excluding bats is not legal. So our cave bat species are threatened species. And in order to protect them during their vulnerable nesting raising young, we cannot do that exclusion from June 1st to August 15th. And that's when the females have their pups and they're flightless or they're still nursing. So during that time period, exclusion is not allowed unless you have a special permit or permission due to a human health and safety concern. So
there you go, Brianne. And just as
thank you. Yeah, but I was just going to say thank you so much for doing this for bats, because they are struggling as a population because of white nose syndrome, and can use all the help that we can provide them. So thank you very, very much for caring about them.
Yeah. And just as an aside, that DNR website is a great website. I really like their revised. It's been a while now since it's been revised, but it is really a good website.
Well, and the bat team of biologists deserves a lot of credit, too. And they do some phenomenal research and monitoring. And you can also subscribe to a newsletter, an electronic newsletter called the Bat Echolocator, the Echolocator. And so if you're really interested in staying up on what's going on in terms of research and with Wisconsin bats, that's a great, great option.
Linda in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm really interested in getting my three, four-year-old grandson learn about birds and about bird song, and that's what we're trying to teach him right now. So I would like to know if you have any sources of tapes where it will say, like, cardinal, and then give the cardinal song so that I can take it out to the woods with him and him play that song and then have him listen for it.
Yeah, so that's a good question, and I'm really happy you're sharing this with the younger generation. And what a fun way to stay connected with your grandkids to do something like this. But one thing you might want to think about doing, if you have not already, is download the app called Merlin, Merlin. It's a free download. It's got you can download packets or packages of birds in different areas of the world. But that has, all the information you would ever need to identify a bird you see. And it also has songs and calls on there. So that's a great thing to do. There are a number of CDs, or again, you probably could download as an app or like an MP3 file. Now, Peterson, learn bird songs, where you can learn bird songs. Stokes, S-T-O-K-E-S, is another one. And I really like the John Fife, F-I-F-E, I think is one of the best ones out there. And so those are all ones that you could use. And again, it's just a matter of, you know, introducing a few bird songs at a time, get to know them, build the confidence of understanding the, and recognizing those songs, and then just continue to add on to that library. But it is awesome that you're doing this, and it is just such a fun, fun activity.
Yeah, that Merlin app is really cool. I like that one for sure. And I hope you are liking what you're hearing on the show today, because David Drake and Jamie Nag have been answering a broad variety of questions. And I hope you'll join in with yours. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick break for a look at the news and to find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at wildlife here in the state with Jamie Nack and David Drake. Jamie, a senior wildlife outreach specialist. David's a wildlife specialist and professor. Both are within the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org or phone 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Jeannie emailed to say that with a photo of a bird she thinks is a leucistic dark-eyed junco, and wonders, that's a nice close-up picture. What do you think, Jamie Nack?
Yeah.
Or David, sure. You want to do it?
Well, I think we're in agreement, so and we agree with Jean. So it is a leucistic dark-eyed junco. So beautiful photo.
Yeah. And we had a nice photo of a red-headed woodpecker from someone found in their yard near Sauk County. So that was nice. Here's a call from Dennis in Two Rivers. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. A neighbor said she saw a muskrat go under my porch. Now, I know last year there'd be a rabbit eating weeds on my lawn because I don't use pesticides, don't use herbicides. So when I'd be eating breakfast, the rabbit would be having its breakfast and go under my porch. So I didn't wonder, well, if there's a rabbit, would the muskrat be under there too? Or what should I be aware of if there is a muskrat? Because I live about half a mile from a river.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a muskrat.
Yeah, it certainly could be a muskrat. And again, they're one of those animals you wouldn't necessarily confuse, because they're kind of a sable brown, almost a wedge-shaped body, and a relatively long hairless tail that is also brown. And obviously you see them swimming in the waters quite often, but they do move quite a bit across land. And so who knows why it's under there, if it was just traveling or if there's something under there it's eating or it's investigating. But you may want to just tuck your head under there with the light and make sure that it's not denning under there. So muskrats typically don't den that far from water, but they will create dens and banks, and they're very good at burrowing. So you want to make sure that there's not burrowing in there for any reason. If it is, you want to get it out of there and then put some kind of a barrier up so that it can't continue to burrow, and it either block it off so that nothing can get under your deck, using some kind of a lattice work or fencing or something like that would probably be the easiest thing. And it might be, if your deck is open anyway, it might not be such a bad idea to just block that off generally to avoid rabbits going under there, skunks, raccoons, other things like that.
Woodchucks.
I was just going to say the same thing. I think, you know, another possibility is that you've got a woodchuck. Regardless, the solution is the same as David described. So.
It might be a woodchuck. However, I have not seen woodchucks up yet this year. So that's the only reason I didn't say that, is because woodchucks, I think, are probably, and especially at Two Rivers, probably should still be hibernating and under the ground. But that's another possibility.
David in Utica, we'll go to you now. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a comment and then a question. I listened with some amusement to your conversation several minutes ago about the feral cat issue and suggesting that they be hunted. And I live in rural Dane County. I'm well aware of how the emergence of the coyote population kind of eliminated the necessity to eliminate those cats, at least in rural Dane County. My second question is about coyotes, or my question is about coyotes as well. I know that the wolf and bear definitely have an impact on the deer population, especially the fawn crop. I'm wondering if there's any research about coyotes and the impact that they may have on the deer population. I suppose it would specifically be the fawn crop.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to refer you to, if you just Google or go to an internet search engine, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and then Iowa County Deer Study. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in kind of the far western part of Dane County and the eastern part of Iowa County has had study area out there. And essentially the essence of the study was to look at chronic wasting disease in low and high prevalence parts of the county. But they also looked at predators, predation on deer, and they radio collared both bobcats and coyotes. And they did find the coyotes were a relatively prominent predator on deer. You know, black bears have been as well. Not so much that they're going to do anything to control the deer population, but they certainly will eat deer as they come available to them, either fawns, sick deer. We have a project here in Madison where we put out coyotes, dead deer to bait coyotes into an area, and they will also scavenge on dead deer as well. So deer are can be a valuable food item for coyotes. How much they rely on them probably depends on where they are in the landscape.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 with your wildlife question. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Steve in Evansville emailed a photo of holes or dens all over his vegetable farm, both on field edges and in uncultivated grassy areas. He doesn't find a footprint in the disturbed soil. The holes are about 12 inches in diameter. Any idea what might have made these holes?
Yeah, so David and I had a chance to take a look at those photos a little bit more and talk on the break. And, you know, we're both leaning towards a groundhog or woodchuck. One thing you might want to do, because it is pretty important to confirm who's causing the problem to be successful in mitigating the damage. But if you put up a trail camera, especially on the edge of those fields, you might be able to get some photos of the animal to confirm the identity. But if it is a woodchuck, they are not protected on certainly on private lands. There is a hunting and trapping season for them. I take that back. You need to have a license is what it is, but there's no bag limit or season. So you could trap them. You could shoot them. Another option that I would like to hear what David thinks about, but just running electric, because you have a fairly large vegetable farm that you're trying to protect. So depending on how much loss you're willing to take, if it becomes costly, you could consider running electrical fence around that plot and just like 6 inches off the ground to keep them from coming in. So I'll kick it to David to see, you know, if that's feasible.
Yeah, I think certainly a electrical fence could work depending on where you are. If you border, you know, an urban area, I know you're in Evansville, but if you border an urban area, electric fencing sometimes is not the most practical just simply because you have domestic pets and kids and things like that. I will refer you to one place. We have a fact sheet on groundhog or woodchuck damage management, and you can find it at wildlifedamage.cals.wisc.edu, and it's wildlifedamage.cals.wisc.edu. So take a look at that fact sheet. The other thing you might want to do right now is that groundhogs will be waking up from hibernation and become active above ground here probably in the next couple of weeks or so. One thing you might want to do is start to fumigate those burrows that you find now and see if you can knock the population down while they're in the burrow, and before they become too active and become above ground. So that might be the other thing I would suggest. You can also trap and relocate. If you relocate those animals, you need the permission of the landowner upon which you are releasing the animal. You can live trap and euthanize the animals as well. But in your situation, I think that probably some kind of a lethal management, maybe in combination with a non-lethal approach, but certainly a lethal approach would be probably practical based on the extent of the damage that you indicate.
Steve in Adams County, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, last spring, I saw a badger building his badger den. I know it was a badger because he looked just like Bucky. But now his the hole is kind of covered over. I was wondering, do they come back again?
Yeah, likely still going to be in the same area, but perhaps a different den location. So, you know, within a mile or two of that area, I would think is a reasonable expectation. They're just so secretive and elusive that you don't often get to see them. So I'd consider yourself quite privileged to have that encounter.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, thank you for calling. John in New London, on to you. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Bobcats. My neighbors and I have seen some bobcats on our land. He saw one actually during the day while he was deer hunting, and then I've had a picture of two of them on a trail cam right around dusk or early morning. I'm wondering if we got to worry about them sticking around, since they've been around since last fall and we're seeing tracks this spring in the snow. If there's much worry about them taking down fawns or our pets, sometimes our cats are outside.
David, do you want to talk about that?
I'll start with this. It's unlikely. I mean, I think if they've been around since last fall, as you indicate, and they probably have been around even before that, you just may not be aware of it. And if you haven't noticed any negative impacts, it's unlikely that you're going to see anything in the future going forward as well. So I would enjoy having them around. They're a native species of wildlife. They belong on the landscape. Again, from a cat standpoint, we talked about this a little bit earlier in the program, but it's better that you keep your cats indoors anyway. It's better for small mammals, birds, things like that. And it's also better for your cat's health. So if you can, keep your cats inside. But I wouldn't worry too much about it. There are, you know, depending on where you are in the state, there's quite a few deer, so it's unlikely that the bobcats are going to impact the deer population to begin with. And again, just enjoy seeing them when you get a chance to see them, because they are relatively secretive and not the easiest animal to see.
Just to go along with that, Jerry called in to say he's got a farm, and he says outdoor cats on his farm are very important for controlling rats and other vermin. So what are the options to cats in that kind of situation?
Yeah, and it's hard because, you know, they don't necessarily know the boundaries and so on, and I can understand and appreciate the value of a cat around a farm. So, you know, encouraging them to certainly have them neutered or spayed is a good idea, and only keeping as many as you absolutely feel you need to control that rodent population around the farmstead. So
the other thing I'll say is, you know, and this is difficult, I understand, especially if you're running a dairy operation, for example, but as much as you can control the sanitation on the farm, so you know, don't provide access to feed sources any more than you necessarily have to. I know this is difficult with rain events and melting snow right now, but try to get rid of as many puddles of water as you possibly can, because that will prevent access to water for a lot of different species like rats and things you don't want around the farm. And then perhaps having some kind of a trapping program going on where you hire a pest control company to come and you have some kind of a maintenance trapping program going on, most likely year round. Those all will help as well.
Let's go to Nick in Madison next. Hi, Nick.
Oh, just a bird observation. Between 10 and 20 years ago, I kept track of when birds arrive and when they start singing. And cardinals first start their spring singing, averaged like the last week of February, the first couple of weeks of March. This year, I don't think it's global warming. I'm not sure why, but they started, I don't know the exact date, but they started the third week of January, almost 5 weeks ahead of they did 10 to 20 years ago.
Yeah. I've heard them too, and I love hearing cardinals call, and I've heard a few.
Yeah, I had as well a couple of weeks ago and thought that was a little early. I wanted to just point out the phenology calendar that the Aldo Leopold Foundation publishes. I think callers might, I know it's advertised on public radio in the past too, and you've had Stan Temple on, but that might be something really interesting for the listeners. And so it's a 12-month calendar and has the average start times or arrival times of a variety of wildlife happenings and plants as well. And so if you go to the Aldo Leopold Foundation's website, I'm guessing, hoping that there's still some available from the 2022 phenological calendar. So
yeah, I've got
you
it.
Might want to check that out.
But so why they're calling why you noticed that 5 weeks earlier, that's a good question. And,
yeah.
You know, we do see drift or creep based on climate change and some other factors and things like that. But typically it's more incremental. And it's not that, I mean, that's a pretty drastic change. And
in 20
who
years.
Knows, yeah. Who knows why exactly it could just be a weather, you know, a kind of a weather related event that it's warmer, for example, or maybe there's more cardinals in the area and they feel the need to start competing for mates earlier. Who knows? But that is that's a pretty drastic change.
Thanks, Nick, for calling. Appreciate it. Pete in McQuantico emailed that for the past 2 years, almost to the day, he's observed a kettle of raptors flying overhead that appear to be almost pure white when viewed from below. It was mid-February of this year and last, but only present for 2 or 3 days. And this year he noticed the darker tips on the pointed wings. Any thoughts on that? That should be a little clue.
To me, it's early in the year, but I mean that, and again, I know he's talking about raptors, but size is relative, especially depending on how far away you are. But the black tips, it sounds like a whooping crane, although this is the wrong time of the year for that to be. But we do have a number of raptors coming through right now. It could be rough-legged hawks. It could be broad-winged hawks possibly as well. You know, the broad-winged hawks especially will have that kind of a darker outline on the underside of their wing. But those would be my guesses.
A couple of callers have heard sandhill cranes in the Sauk Prairie area this year already.
Yeah. Yep, I've heard sandhill cranes. I think Jamie said she has as well, so...
Yeah,
they're here.
Yeah, they're here already. But it does. David had emailed earlier and saying it seems a bit early for. He's from Madison. He remembers seeing cranes in the area well into last December, which he thought was late in the season for them.
Yeah, they are one of the later leaving birds in the fall. So you know, it's not uncommon to see them mid-November for sure. And depending on, you know, last year we had a relatively warm winter, beginning of the winter. So for them to be here early December is not surprising.
Jamie, I want to go back to you a minute because, and bears have come up in the conversation once or twice today already, but you want to remind us about that black bear den research.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, this is another opportunity for the public to contribute to science and to data gathering for the Department of Natural Resources. But if anybody is aware of a current or a previous year's black bear den, the Department of Natural Resources would be very interested in hearing more information about it. There are 6 black bear management zones within the state, and the Office of Applied Science is looking to kind of refine their population models for black bears on a more to fine-tune the data that goes into that modeling and to figure out on a zone specific, what is the average litter size for black bears and so on. So what they would like to do is be able to find some black bears in their dens, be able to collar the female black bears, collect data on each of the bears, including recording the sex, the weight, and body measurements of the sow and cubs. And again, doing this throughout the state so they can use that information to hone in those population models on a zone-specific scale. So if you know of any information related to black bear dens, and they can be hard to find, the majority of dens in Wisconsin are found either as a tip-up mound, so a tree that's tipped over. They'll excavate that area where the root ball is, dig a hole, excavate their own den, or a brush pile, or in the case of where maybe some clear cutting's been done, get underneath that brush. And in fewer cases, but still does happen, bears will just den right on the surface. They'll pull grasses and kind of build themselves a surface nest. So if you're aware of any of these den locations, you can go to the DNR's website and type in Wisconsin Black Bear Litter Survey, and they'd be happy to get that information from you.
David, there have been a couple of recent studies that have found contradictory evidence that COVID has affected wildlife vehicle collisions.
Yeah, so, you know, when COVID first started, we were getting a lot of reports, especially what's called this anthropause, where we had a global shutdown, essentially, in human activity when COVID first hit back in the spring of 2020. And so now people are starting to, you know, publish some studies that have looked at some of the data about that. And we do have some contradictory results. So there was a study that was done primarily looking at some European countries, but also Estonia and Israel, where they were looking at wildlife vehicle collisions. And they found that wildlife vehicle collisions decreased during that anthropause or that break, primarily between about 19 to 40%, depending on what the country was. So the vehicle collisions decreased. Here in the United States, they looked at a study across the United States, and they found that initially when the anthropause first started in spring of 2020, that there was a reduction in wildlife vehicle collisions. But then it relatively quickly came back to the same number of animals were getting killed, and then it rapidly increased. And they think that that was because they were seeing a change in animal movement behavior during that anthropause, that when we were locked down and the humans weren't moving as much across the landscape, the animals were then getting closer to roadways. And because you had more animals coming closer to roadways, even though you had less traffic, you had an increase in wildlife vehicle collisions. So it's been pretty interesting.
It is indeed. It's always interesting when the two of you stop by. Thank you both so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to your next visit in a couple of months. Thanks, Jamie, and thanks, David. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Always great to have them with us. They come by every couple of months on the first Wednesday of the month. Scott Craven comes in the alternate month. All right. Inga Witcher will be back with us to talk about her upcoming Around the Farm Table special tomorrow. She'll be doing that. And then at 11:45, we'll look back at another Wisconsin cooking show host, Carson Gully. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.